Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
I like sent the professional email, like, you know, I understand, you know, but I really am disappointed that you have not acknowledged whatsoever your financial commitment to this gig, you know, like, you guys were going to pay me, right? Like, you have the money in your budget, right? So pay me.
This is Death, Sex, and Money, the show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale. I first saw choreographer Miguel Gutierrez perform around this time last year in San Francisco. He was presenting a piece called Unsustainable Solutions, Duet with My Dead Dad, a solo dance where he interacts with video recordings of his late father, who died last year. The piece ends with the audience lights up and Miguel staring into the eyes of the crowd while he scream sings along to Bruce Springsteen's Downbound Train.
Last night I heard your voice, you were crying, crying, you were so alone. You said your love had never died, you were waiting for me at home.
I've thought about that piece a lot since, its anger and grief. That performance was also one of the last times that Miguel was on stage. All of his onstage gigs since March have been canceled. And when we talked over FaceTime, I asked how that's felt.
In very honest terms, my first feeling is one of relief.
Oh, interesting.
You know, performing for me is not necessarily the romance that I think so many people make it out to be. It feels like a necessary component of the work, but it's not always the most pleasant part of it. There are so many kind of components of, interaction that are challenging or just like vulnerability. And I think it's been like a reprieve just to be like, okay, I'm just taking in this very different reality, but I'm not sitting around every day being like, oh my God, I can't wait to get back to the theater.
Miguel is 49, and for his entire adult life, he's been a professional artist. He's a musician who's played in a few bands and has a project called Sad Donna, where he sings Madonna songs, but in a sad way. But Miguel is best known for his work as a choreographer and dancer and has received some of the field's highest honors. And like many people working in creative industries, he's lost a lot of work and income this year. A report from the Brookings Institution found that fine arts and the performing arts have been particularly hard hit. Overall, 2.3 million jobs and $74 billion in average monthly earnings were lost in the creative fields between April and July of this year. And while Miguel was less concerned about not being on stage during the pandemic, he was concerned about how he'd get paid.
The first thing I noticed was all the cancellation emails and their complete lack of acknowledgement of a financial component to the interaction or the transaction that was, like, you know, binding us. And I just, so my first reaction was anger.
Those were emails from, like, dance festivals and venues, or, like, what
venues,
were those emails?
I mean, you know, there were venues, there were, you know, my work is interdisciplinary, so it was a variety of kinds of work, you know, in what I do, teaching and performing, and kind of across the board, you know, these cancellation emails were coming in, and all with the exception of one, made no mention of the loss of income.
What did they say if they didn't mention money?
They were like, oh, you know, as you can understand, the situation has changed and we have to, you know, close the season early or we won't be able to do the festival or yada, yada, yada. You know, we're so sorry about this. You know, we look forward to talking to you again soon or wish you the best right now. It was this very kind of like formulaic, cordial thing. And, you know, some of these institutions were people I'd been talking to for months. Some of them were institutions I'd known for years or had worked at for years.
Did you respond and say, can we talk about the money?
Yes. Like first, like a kind of like strongly worded email. And then I wrote this like Instagram rant. I kind of went off, you know, like what the heck's going on here?
I have it in front of me, this particular post. It's in all caps. Short-term work is my work. My bills are not being postponed and my food isn't free. Hashtag gig economy, hashtag pay independent artists, hashtag honor commitments, hashtag not disposable, hashtag I'm in your budget.
Girl, she went with all of those hashtags. Hashtag.
I loved it in the moment. I was just like, you know, yeah. I think this came out the week where everything was shut down and it was like, oh my gosh, what is happening to creative people who are living gig to gig?
You know, like even though I'm doing pretty well, I mean, I've done very well in this field. I'm very, very fortunate, but I'm still going gig to gig, you know, and I have no job security. I'm still completely at the whim of whether a presenter or a festival wants to hire me this year or not. And so, you know, you're always stitching together your income in this profession. And, you know, you're using April to pay for May, you're using June to pay for July. You know, it's like, you know, if it would be one thing if I hadn't had those commitments, right? Like, yeah, then I would have had to just figure it out. But given that there were these things lined up, and I think it's one of the things that is so confusing to me about this field, because there's this kind of purported friendliness and this kind of like, you know, we're all in this for the love of it. You know, we're all in this for the, you know, the beauty and the love of art and the belief and the hub, you know, and it's like, yeah, but when push comes to shove, I'm also in it to get paid. Like, this is my work. These were strongly worded emails, but I felt really like clear that I had to send this message. And then of course, all of the people were like, oh yes, of course. You know,
oh,
like,
really?
Oh, yeah, sure. Money.
So then they wrote you some checks?
For the most part.
Wow.
Yeah. Then they wrote me back and they're like, oh yeah, well we're going to have a meeting and you know, suddenly it was like this, like save your ass kind of response. And I was like, no, this is where you should have started. This should not be like, it is not my job as the person that you've contracted to hold your feet to the fire on such a basic aspect of our commitment to each other. And then the other thing I would say that I noticed right away was also how many sort of like first at like individual artists were setting up like relief funds. And then of course foundations as well, or were suddenly coming up with these kinds of relief funds. And I had very mixed feelings about, well, I mean, I applied for all the things I could apply for, you know, because let's be honest, I'm a hustler and I'll take the money where I can get it. But I felt frustrated, like the people who are the most vulnerable, you know, contribute the most to their own ongoing survival. And I just, it makes me so angry that we have to immediately fend for ourselves because we have so little protection from the government.
Do you have a sense of how much money you lost due to COVID?
Probably somewhere from $15,000 to $20,000. That wasn't just going to go to me, but just also the people that work with me.
So your whole sort of operation, people who work with you.
Yeah.
Is that a loss that you are going to be able to absorb without big changes?
Well, you know, like I said, I applied for everything I could. I got a lot of that stuff. You know, I of course eventually applied for the unemployment that I could, and which came with the extra little boost of the $600. And then I hustled and I got a lot of like virtual guest artist gigs throughout the spring, like March, April, May. I was suddenly visiting schools and institutions all over the world.
From your apartment. Know,
like,
yeah.
I was actually in my mom's house in Florida, and I was like holding up in my father's old office. So there was all kinds of feelings about that. None of those things were like paying some crazy amount of money, but they paid decent. And you know, like I just did what we always do. So I haven't sat down and done the numbers. I can't tell you exactly if I recouped the exact amount, but I did okay.
And did you? You've been a professional artist for decades. Like, did COVID like lay bare some of these labor dynamics in a way that you, like, did you see them in a new way?
I mean, it made it very plain, but it's completely not new. You know, there was a kind of concentration to the experience of, you know, losing a gig, and, you know, but gigs fall apart all the time, and precarity is sort of the ground floor of this field. And this idea that you don't know if you're going to, you know, be okay next year, that feeling that is, I mean, that's a constant. And then that's been a constant for me kind of my whole professional career. You know, I mean, I've been lucky, and I kind of in general, I'm like, okay, it's going to be okay. But, you know, part of how it was okay was certainly for the first, you know, 2/3 of my professional career, part of it, how it was okay, was that my life was relatively cheap, and I very foolishly did not pay my debts. So, you know, that was kind of my strategy for a long time. And that was not a great move on my part, but it's the move I made.
Coming up, more about how Miguel got into debt as a young adult and how an unexpected windfall got him out of it years later.
I knew, I was like, okay, Miguel, this is your chance. Like, fucking pay this shit off now. Don't even look at this money. Don't even, you know, touch it. You don't look at it. You know, you just boom, pay this debt off. Get it out of your life.
As COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations rise across the country, we've been thinking about the healthcare workers we've heard from this year. The nurse named Lindsay, who sent in a voice memo about struggling to give people a good death during the pandemic, wrote in to say that right now in her Philadelphia hospital, the mood is tense.
Something I feel like we've been dealing with on our end is just exhaustion. I think that everyone is tired of all the pandemic restrictions, but we, as healthcare workers, feel this collective anxiety, as if we're all holding our breath, like waiting for the next wave to affect us.
Lindsay worked in an ICU with COVID patients last spring. She's now back working in a pediatric oncology unit.
It's really hard for my pediatric patients to have limited visitors, especially around the holidays. I know for me personally, not having the therapy dogs can be challenging.
But Lindsay also said that work has felt like a reprieve at times,
keeping her busy and away from consuming too much news. And she told us that a Death, Sex, and Money listener who heard her story this summer donated an iPad to the ICU where she'd been working for COVID patients to connect with their families. You can find more updates from the healthcare workers we've gotten to know during the pandemic in our newsletter, like from Sharon, the CNA in Virginia, who is now working on getting her associate's degree. Read those updates and sign up to get our newsletter at deathsexmoney.org/newsletter. On the next episode, your stories about living alone. At a time when a lot of us are feeling isolated, we reflect on some of the drawbacks of solo living and what's awesome about it.
There's nobody to tell me not to have a dance party late at night.
It's actually quite pleasing.
Curl up, roll a joint, and watch Golden Girls by myself.
I love it to the point of writing sonnets about it if I were the sonnet type.
Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home. And you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on death, sex, and money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM+ to get access wherever you listen. Thanks. This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. Miguel Gutierrez's parents immigrated to the U.S. from Colombia. His mother worked as a draftsperson, making technical drawings for city planning, and his dad was an electronics engineer. Miguel started dancing at an early age, but his parents made clear that being an artist was not a career path they envisioned for him.
They completely did not understand it. They were fearful of it, I think, from two perspectives. One, of course, as immigrants, they were, you know, their plans for me and my sister were, you know, to have professional lives and sort of traditional professional careers. You know, that was sort of what they, I think, were hoping for as the product of the labor that they'd gone through as immigrants in this country. And then the second thing was just homophobia. They were just, you know, when I, you know, decided I wanted to go into dance, they, you know, I didn't know this expressly at the time, but later when I came out to my parents, my dad was like, I knew if I let you take ballet, you'd turn out this way, you know?
Really?
And I was like, oh, okay. So yeah, you know, fears confirmed. Now I know why you were being such a hard ass about me doing that. You know, I was kind of classic story of like the young, like sort of girly homo boy who doesn't want to do sports. And like dancing was one of the first places I experienced my body as my own. My sister and I would improvise for each other when we were kids. Like one person would put on music, the person would just go dancing and dance for the other person. So it was very like personal and also very like treasured, this experience with my sister. And then you know, I think that, like I said, there was a kind of almost like defiance, you know, because I fought to do it. I did fight my parents to get to be able to dance as a kid. And so by the time my dad and my mom came around to accepting that I was doing this, you know, and my dad started trying to be like, maybe you should audition for like Disney, you know, and be on a cruise boat. And I was like, not really what I'm doing that, you know, no hate on those people. Those are amazing artists. They have to dance all freaking day. But that's like, that wasn't the path I was going on.
And so, and did your parents talk to you about money?
No. It's like, my sister and I talk about this all the time. It's like, they really did not teach us any kind of financial literacy. And, you know, my sister and I are 5 years apart. So, and she skipped a grade. So she essentially was 6 years ahead of me. And so the economic life my parents were living was much better by the time I was a teenager than when my sister was one. And I think maybe they're, unfortunately, like they were trying to protect us from a conversation about money and the precarity that they experienced, because my father worked for himself eventually in the 80s. He started his own company, and it was just, you know, he was kind of like me. He was freelancing, essentially getting you know, gigs. And but they just didn't talk about it at home. They didn't, you know, my mom was like, you know, you have to remember to save money. Like, you know, I think that was like the kind of extent, but like, I didn't know what credit was. I didn't know what, you know, paying a bill on time looked like. It was like things just kind of happened, you know. It was this kind of privilege that I had that actually kept me out of the world of knowing of what things actually costed.
And when you think back on your younger self and the choices you made creatively, like, do you think that that privilege or that silence around money helped you be more brave?
I wouldn't characterize it as brave, because brave would suggest that there was real courage involved. It was like a combination of like, I was dumb about money. And, you know, I knew that if the shit really hit the fan, I could go stay with my parents, you know, like there was, or my sister could help me, you know, like I did have backed up. It's this thing where you know, you'll have a place to turn if things go really south. I mean, you know, they went south financially for me in that, like, I started accruing debt really quickly and I did not deal with it for years and years and years. And so by not dealing with it, it of course just ballooned. But I do think that instead, really what was happening was because I had forged somewhat of a solitary path as an artist without a ton of support from my parents for a long time, there was this kind of single-mindedness on my part of like, this is the thing that I will make happen. And if it means that I go into debt, if it means that I don't pay certain things on time, if it means that I don't open that letter from the loan collector, you know, so be it, because I'm going to do this fucking thing, you know, and there was that was a very clear drive.
How did you decide to leave school? How did you know that you didn't want to be in college when you first went?
Well, I think I had kind of talked the talk in high school, even of like, that maybe I wasn't going to go to college at all, you know, and I would just kind of like right away try to have a professional life. And I was very caught up in kind of classical notions of dancerly success, which meant that by the age of 17, you're a professional in a ballet company. And I thought that to be like a 25-year-old dancer was already old. And then also because of my, you know, closetedness in high school, I got to college and I just exploded sexually. I was just like voraciously sexual and, you know, like the school slut, you know, I was just like, here I am, let's do it boys, you know, and, you know, let me screw all the gay boys. And then now I did all the gay boys. Good. Let me screw all the questioning boys, you know, like, let me be the conduit to gay, you know, for, doing the recruitment work for the community. And any ability I had to be an academic person literally left me. Mm-hmm. Like I would literally look at a book and it was like suddenly the words were jumbled up. Like I couldn't focus. All I could do was like party, hook up with guys, and go to rehearsal. Like those were the things I was good at.
That's still what I went to rehearsal. Rehearsal was still important.
Rehearsal was still primary for me. Like no matter what else I did, I was always present and I was always, you know, fully in. And so I spent a year at Brown. I took a year off to do a bunch of queer activist stuff in California. And then I went back to Brown. And by the second year that I was at school, I was like taking four dance classes a day. And I was like, what the hell am I doing here? So I transferred to NYU and I went there for a year. But again, the sort of panic of my age really kicked in. I was 21. So I was like, you know what? Fuck this. I'm going to freak my parents out by dropping out of college because, ooh, that's such a bourgeois rebellious act, right? That's like what I thought was like super rebellious. And I knew that it would hurt them. And I think I wanted to hurt them.
As you were having these conflicts with your parents, did financial support come and go?
They were paying for school to what they could, you know, and I had some loans. But once I left, I was kind of on my own.
When you talk about the foolhardy money management of your younger years and the debt, what was the debt made up of?
Oh, I literally went into collections like a week after I started college because I got a subscription to Newsweek that I never paid. Like there was one, like that's like the most pathetic credit score fail of all time. Like fucking Newsweek, like sorry Newsweek, but like really? And then I'd gotten loans, of course, and you know, knew nothing about what defaulting on a loan meant, or I didn't know how to, you know, ask for an extension. I didn't really understand what like a loan was. So I didn't deal with that. I mean, I was able to pay for my life and I was able to pay for my rent. And, you know, and we haven't even gotten into this whole other beautiful part of the prism, which was my alcoholism, which was a whole other fun part of the picture, which also helped me to be financially irresponsible.
Was there a crisis that led to you getting sober?
Yes. There are multiple crises. One was a physical one. I was 26, 27, and I couldn't like bend my foot. I was diagnosed with gout. And I was like, I'm 26 years old. Like I'm a professional dancer. I probably should be able to bend my foot. You know, I was 6 months behind on my $250 a month rent. I was working at B Bar, this like fancy restaurant, and making, you know, probably anywhere between $150 to $200 a night and coming home with like $20 to $40, being like, where did all my money go? It was a lot.
So you, for you, like part of the crises of your alcoholism was related to money running out.
Absolutely. It was a total abdication of financial responsibility. It was just like there was a ton of shame. It was just like, I just didn't tell people, you know, I just didn't tell people. And even for years after I got sober, I still couldn't open those letters from the loan collectors.
And so this is like early 2000s. When you think back on, was there a year where you're like, that's the year I started to feel like I was financially making it as an artist?
Well, in 2010, I was really lucky. I got three different awards. I got a Foundation for Contemporary Art Award, which I used to pay off my credit card debt, which, you know, my card was maxed out. I got the United States Artists Fellowship, which I used to pay 5 years of back taxes.
Wow.
And then I got a Guggenheim. So I'm laughing. I mean, I'm laughing just because it's like, and the Guggenheim I was able to like live off of, you know, like I, but those other two awards, I mean, I was so lucky that happened. And so kind of, you know, and like what? I was what, 39 when that happened? And so from there forward, I was able to kind of build a somewhat of a debt-free life. But it wasn't until I got another award in 2016, when I got the Doris Duke Artist Award, that I was able to gather enough money to like for my future. You know, like I bought an apartment last year, which was a huge deal, and only possible because of that award.
I'm just kind of struck, like, it seems like in 2010, like, you were the thing that everyone turned their head to and were like, let's give him money this year.
Yeah, I got lucky.
And does that, like, when that happens, does it make, like, was the feeling like, how do I make this moment not go away?
You know, I've been lucky because I know that kind of fortune favors you for a brief amount of time. You know, it's just the case in any art field that there are moments when a certain artist or a certain person is sort of, you know, living high off the hog, you know, like doing better, right? There's a, you know, you'll see the funding cycles, like the same names for a couple of years, and then, you know, they fall off the map, and then the next crop of names comes up, you know, and I talk about it as like the promiscuity of the field. It's like, you know, you're in this kind of constant promiscuity of commitment. You know, you're like fucking this venue this year, then you're fucking that venue the next year. You know, it's like that's kind of the nature of the work. It's as that you have these brief, quite intense, sometimes quite emotional connections that dissipate, and that becomes exhausting over time. And I mean, I think that is something also that coronavirus has absolutely sort of you know, it's fucked with my head of like, okay, you know, there's a whole other part of me. It's like, do I ever want to tour again? Actually, do I ever need to spend one more lonely night in a hotel room in bumfuck wherever? I know this is so like, maybe it's like so gross to say, but like, I actually crave certain kinds of normalcy that maybe are just part of other people's lives sometimes. And, you know, these are things that I thought were indicators of some kind of arrival or, you know, success that I wanted, that I fought for, that I tried to get, that I won and I did get. And so, and there's definitely a part of that where I'm like, maybe that's no longer the ambition.
That is Miguel Gutierrez. You can see his rant on Instagram about getting paid and get updates on his work by following him at A Boy Like That. Miguel is teaching at Princeton this year, and he's a student again. He re-enrolled at Brown to finish the degree he started in 1989. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. Afi Yellowduke produced this episode. The rest of our team includes Katie Bishop, Annabelle Bacon, Emily Botine, and Andrew Dunn. Thank you to Dr. Melissa Bell for taking me to the dance festival and introducing me to Miguel's work last year. The Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. I'm on Twitter at Anna Sayo. The show is at Death Sex Money on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And thanks to Karen Capen in Alameda, California, who is a sustaining member of Death, Sex, and Money. Join Karen and support what we do here by going to deathsexmoney.org/donate. As Miguel's been working from home and thinking about art and commerce, he's also decided to make a podcast about it.
It's gonna be called Are You For Sale?
Okay. Are you for sale?
Yeah, are you for sale?
No,
yeah.
Art, I'm asking you.
Honey, I'm for rent. You can sublet this shit. I don't even know if you want to buy me, but you can certainly rent me.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.